We'll hear argument now in number 85-1910, Business Electronics Corporation versus Sharp Electronics Corporation. Mr. McGowan, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this antitrust case arises under Section 1 of the Sherman Act and involves an allegation of vertical price fixing. It concerns two independent dealers in Houston, Texas, who bought calculators from Sharp Electronics Corporation and resold those calculators to their customers. The jury below found an agreement between Sharp and Hartwell, Hartwell being one of the dealers in Houston, to terminate the petitioner Business Electronics, the other dealer in Houston, for the purpose of eliminating price cutting, an agreement to eliminate price cutting. On appeal, Sharp did not contest the sufficiency of the evidence supporting that jury finding, but instead, the issue in this appeal is whether an agreement to stop price cutting by terminating the price cutter is a per se violation of the Sherman Act. The Fifth Circuit below held that such an agreement did not constitute price fixing. The Court said that a finding of price fixing required, literally, an agreement to charge resale prices at some level. The decision below, which carves out conspiracies to eliminate price cutting from the definition of resale price maintenance, should be reversed for several reasons. First of all, such a rule would eviscerate the per se rule against price fixing. The per se rule would be so narrow as to catch only blatant smoking gun cases of price fixing. Such a rule would deter only the ill-informed and unsophisticated. It could easily be avoided. Instead of agreeing on price directly, suppliers and dealers who wish to achieve adherence to resale prices could simply collude to terminate dealers who refuse to charge those prices. Second, a conspiracy to terminate dealers who don't comply with suggested resale prices is clearly a form of resale price maintenance under the decisions of this Court. This Court has never limited the definition of vertical price fixing to direct agreements on price. In Park Davis and Albrecht, for example, the Court said that resale price maintenance need not take the form of an actual agreement on price. It's enough for the plaintiff to show collusion to enforce suggested resale prices. And this makes sense. There is no meaningful difference between a direct agreement on price and a conspiracy to terminate dealers because they charge lower prices.
Depends on what you mean, lower than what. Was it established here that the non-terminated dealer would only charge list price all the time, and that the price cutter was always cutting below list? That wasn't established, was it?
It was established here, Your Honor, that the terminated dealer was continually discounting, and it was established that the non-terminated dealer wanted to avoid that discounting.
But sometimes discounted himself. He wasn't always selling at the manufacturer's suggested retail price, was it?
There is evidence that he sometimes discounted himself, Your Honor. But
so you really can't say for sure that by terminating the other one for discounting, what you were establishing is, in effect, the manufacturer's suggested retail price. Or at least we don't know that for certain.
What we can say for certain is that a price cutter, a firm that clearly was charging lower than the manufacturer's suggested resale prices, was taken out of the marketplace in order to get rid of that price cutting. But this is a form of agreement on price because it's, in effect, an agreement which says these lower prices should not be charged by that dealer.
Well, Mr. McGowan, why couldn't an agreement to eliminate a price cutter reflect an agreement to maintain the conditions necessary for the continuation of some pre-sale promotional practices instead?
Well, Your Honor, that contention was raised in this case, and it's the so-called free riding concern, promotional
mm-hmm.
services.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, the evidence showed that, in fact, the plaintiff, Business Electronics, was not a free rider. There was never any complaint from Sharp that he wasn't providing those services. The complaint from Sharp was that he was price cutting.
Well, the facts may show that, but it would seem to me that it speaks to whether there should be the application of a per se rule or not.
Well, the free riding rationale would, in effect, is used here, Your Honor, as a thinly disguised attack on the per se rule in general. The same free rider arguments are made with respect to the per se rule itself. The free rider arguments should not be given any weight in the context of vertical price fixing. In Sylvania, this court alluded to free rider effects, but only in the context of vertical non-price restrictions. And the court made it clear that as to price restrictions, there are significantly different policy concerns and effects. As to price restrictions, the courts will always apply the per se rule.
I don't think you've, at least not to my satisfaction, completely answered Justice O'Connor's question. You say that the free rider consideration shouldn't be taken into account here. But why shouldn't they be? I mean, if we're talking about economic utility and that sort of thing, why shouldn't that consideration, along with many others, be taken into account?
It depends on what you mean by free rider, Your Honor. If free rider means a failure to provide a certain level of minimum promotional services, there are far less restrictive alternatives than vertical price fixing, which can be used to remedy free riding to the extent it's a problem.
Why must we look for the least restrictive alternative in this a statutory case, and it's not a First Amendment case?
Because free riding is a ready label which can always be used to excuse what amounts to a conspiracy to eliminate price cutting. And this case is a good example of that. I mean, there was no evidence that Business Electronics was actually free riding. And, in fact, the evidence showed that if anybody was free riding, it was Hartwell. Because Business Electronics had been an established dealer in this market for 4 years, Hartwell was then appointed. Hartwell then started soliciting customers from Business Electronics. So the free rider rationale, this business of providing additional, inducing dealers to provide additional services, is something that came to life in hindsight, Your Honor. It's not something...
Then your argument is not so much that it doesn't deserve consideration and evaluation of the legal principles, but just that whatever consideration it should get shouldn't apply here because this really wasn't a case of free riding?
This wasn't really a case of free riding, and as to the vertical price restraints as opposed to non-price restraints, free riding should not be a rationale for undermining the per se rule itself. Where you're talking about something that amounts to price fixing, these free rider concerns should not be used to justify price fixing.
But why not?
If you look in the literature, Your Honor, on the subject of free riding, you can look high and low in that literature, and there is almost no empirical basis for it. There is no basis for assuming that this free rider phenomenon is something that is pervasive in our economy or is something that should be used to justify eradication of the
person. Some of us, I dare say all of us, have had some experience of going to some very full-line dealer and, you know, getting the stuff demonstrated and that sort of thing, and then you go to some discount house and buy it there.
Your Honor, another problem with free riding is it prevents consumers from exercising their freedom of choice. A consumer may choose to buy a product at a lower price, even with less service. And even though there may be cases of the so-called free riding that you've described, those cases are probably so narrow and so unusual that they do not justify applying a broad-based rule that would undercut the per se rule.
Well, doesn't the manufacturer have an interest in protecting, to a certain extent, dealers who do provide full service and provide advertising and that sort of thing?
The manufacturer can achieve that interest through contractually requiring those dealers to provide a minimum level of service, to provide a minimum number of salesmen, to provide a minimum showroom floor, and he can terminate those dealers for refusing to comply with those contractual requirements. The manufacturer can also impose non-price vertical restrictions subject to the rule of reason. He can limit territories and customers, for example. But to use vertical price fixing to avoid the free rider problem is like using a shotgun to kill a mouse. It's overly broad. It's crudely broad. It eliminates competition much more than is necessary to cure what is probably a very minor, narrow concern in our economy.
Isn't the respondents who are urging a broad rule, a prophylactic rule, if you will, it's you. That is to say, under what they propose, you can always examine each case one by one and decide whether indeed the free rider concern exists or not. But your principle is you can never even consider that. I am proposing a broad rule. If he's being terminated for charging too low a price, it's a per se violation.
Your Honor, the rationale for the per se rule is based on a judgment that certain practices are likely to be predominantly anti-competitive. And we submit that an agreement to eliminate price cutting, that's what the jury found here, and that's what the evidence supported, an agreement to eliminate price cutting is predominantly anti-competitive. Now, when you apply the per se rule, the per se rule is applied for the sake of litigation efficiency and business certainty. There may be cases, there may be individual cases, where the per se rule catches conduct that doesn't have a terribly anti-competitive effect. But for the sake of litigation efficiency and business certainty, the per se rule is applied. Here, I think it can be generally said that an agreement to stop price cutting by terminating price cutters is predominantly anti-competitive. It's clearly a price restraint. It deserves the per se rule for that reason.
Why would the manufacturer want to cause his products to be sold at a higher price? Unless he had something to gain, such as better promotion and all of these other things that eliminate the free rider prospect.
What? For at least two reasons, Your Honor. First reason being, as Justice Powell recognized in the Sylvania opinion, it may facilitate cartelization of the industry. For example, we have evidence in this case that Sharp's motive in imposing resale price restrictions on its dealers was pursuant to a promise that it made to its competitors not to enter into a meaningless price-cutting war. Sharp would serve as an example for the industry. That's one reason. The second reason, and I think a more obvious reason, is that severe, rigorous price competition at the retail level is eventually going to put back pressure on the manufacturer's wholesale prices. The manufacturer cannot stand there and watch retail prices continue to go down without eventually lowering his own prices.
I have the impression you expected that question.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, the court below said that there was no price fixing here because Hartwell remained free to charge any price he wanted. Now, this theoretical freedom is an artificial distinction. It's unrealistic to suppose that the remaining dealer will use his freedom to do anything other than raise prices or increase margins. I mean, after all, the purpose of the agreement here was to eliminate price cutting. And focusing on the remaining dealer's supposed freedom ignores the reality of the agreement. Its purpose and effect was to destroy Business Electronics' freedom to lower prices. The narrow definition of price fixing adopted by the court below not only runs against this court's precedent and logic, it also violates the antitrust policy laid down by Congress. The best proof of this can be seen in congressional response to the Justice Department's vertical restraints guidelines. In 1985, Congress passed legislation condemning those guidelines as an effort to, quote, dilute or trivialize, quote, the per se rule. And Congress even condemned a statement in the guidelines which comes very close to the holding in this case. And I'll quote briefly. Whereas such policy guidelines...
Where are you reading from?
I'm reading now from page 37 of the petitioner's brief. The quote at the bottom. Whereas such policy guidelines are inconsistent with established antitrust law as reflected in Supreme Court decisions and statements of congressional intent, in stating that vertical restraints that have an impact upon prices are subject to the per se rule of illegality only if there is an explicit agreement as to specific prices. That was one of the things that they specifically condemned in the Justice Department's guidelines.
This was a sense of Congress resolution?
Yes, Your Honor. And it was actually passed. It's signed by the President. In addition, in using its power over appropriations, Congress even went so far as to prohibit the Justice Department from attempting to alter or amend the per se rule, again demonstrating congressional belief that the per se rule should be broadly applied in the area of vertical price fixing. There should be no fear that...
Just what weight ought this Court to give? I mean, this isn't the Congress that enacted the Sherman Act or enacted the Clayton Act or any of the basic acts upon which the various per se rules have been based.
Well, Your Honor, in Sylvania, in distinguishing price from non-price restraints and in reaffirming the application of the per se rule to price restraints, Justice Powell took pains to note that, among other things, Congress had expressly approved the per se rule repeatedly over the years, and most of that indication of congressional intent has occurred since 1975. So it should be given great.
Was he referring to sense of Congress resolutions such as this one?
He was referring to repeal of the Miller-Tidings Act. He was referring to Congress, as in the Square D case, Congress having enacted legislation in the antitrust field without being aware of the per se rule, without altering the per se rule, for example. There should be no fear here that reversal of the Fifth Circuit's narrow definition of price fixing would erode the Sylvania decision. The Court made clear there that price restraints usually reduce both interbrand and intrabrand price competition, that price restraints facilitate cartelizing, and that Congress approved the per se rule. We are not dealing here, as Sharp contends, with a mere exclusive distributorship. This is not a mere agreement to terminate a dealer who happened to be a discounter. An exclusive distributorship is defined as an agreement between a supplier and a distributor whereby the supplier agrees not to appoint any other dealers in a defined territory. It's clearly a non-price restraint. It says nothing about pricing. Here we had a conspiracy aimed specifically at ending price cutting by a dealer, by the only means left available to those who wanted higher prices, and that is termination of the price cutter. Sharp says, well, you got to look at effect. The effect is the same, whether you have an exclusive distributorship or the agreement at issue here. But a bona fide exclusive distributorship may or may not have an adverse effect on inter-brand competition. For example, if Sharp had appointed Business Electronics as its exclusive distributor, a price cutter would have remained in the market and would have represented price competition vis-a-vis inter-brand competition. And even if an exclusive distributorship had the same effect on competition as the agreement here, the availability of lawful means to achieve the same result, the same anti-competitive result, does not excuse the use of conspiracies to eliminate price cutters and unlawful means.
As Mr. McGowan, what do you expect a manufacturer to do when he's confronted with this situation? One of his distributors comes and says, look, I'm a full-service distributor. I do a lot of advertising. Let's assume this is true. I know you say this is not the situation here, but let's assume one distributor who's a good guy, he has a full showroom, and he does all the services. And he comes to the manufacturer and he says, this other fellow is a discounter, and he's killing me. Now, I cannot compete and have these full services the way I have them now. Either terminate him or I'm going to quit. What is the manufacturer supposed to do?
The manufacturer can say, "What we cannot agree to terminate this man because of his discount. And I'm not going to terminate him just because you don't like his discount. What I can do, if it's in my best interest, is I can contractually require that other dealer to provide minimum services. Minimum showroom, number of sales, floor space, and so forth, so that at least he's providing full services like I, the manufacturer, want him to do.
And I have to police those, and only if he violates them and I can prove in a lawsuit that he's violated them can I get out of it.
Right. Well,
it's a rather expensive way to get rid of a distributor.
But the manufacturer is always free to unilaterally terminate a distributor. He's free to set up non-price restrictions, and if the distributor violates those, subject to the rule of reason, he's free to terminate the distributor for those reasons. He is not free, as happened in this case, to enter an agreement, which was uncontested. The sufficiency of the agreement is uncontested. The evidence supporting the agreement is uncontested. He's not free to enter into an agreement to eliminate price cutting by terminating the price cutter. I mean, this is a case where Business Electronics' competitor approached Business Electronics and wanted to engage in a horizontal price-fixing conspiracy. Business Electronics ignored it, refused to do it. Sharp repeatedly requested my client to raise his prices. He refused to do it. It finally got to the point where they got together and said, the only way we can get rid of this distributor is terminating it. That's the only way this price cutting is going to go away. That is illegal, and that is a far cry from unilateral termination or termination because of violation of non-price restrictions. And juries can tell the difference between those two.
Mr. McGowan, is there any evidence in this case that the manufacturer, Sharp, did request the your client to add additional salesmen or additional services or anything else as a condition of retaining his dealership?
There is no evidence that they complained to him about failure to provide a requisite number of services. My client did lose a number of salesmen well before Hartwell was appointed as a dealer and didn't have as many salesmen as Hartwell. And there are memos in the file saying he's working to build back up his sales force. But there's no evidence that they ever came to my client and said, if you don't have more salesmen, we're going to terminate you. Or if you don't provide more advertising, we're going to terminate you. There's not a shred of evidence to support the notion that Sharp cared about the level of advertising that this dealer was doing.
Is the dealership agreement in the record? Are there conditions like that in the standard? Do they use a standard agreement, but the same agreement with both the two dealers?
There is no dealership agreement in the record for Hartwell, I don't believe. And I don't think there's a dealership agreement in the record for Business Electronics either. It was irrelevant to the case, didn't contain any.
Well, does the record show whether Hartwell had all these additional services because he thought it was a good way to run his business or because Sharp required it?
The record shows, as a matter of fact, Your Honor, that Sharp never went to Hartwell before the termination and said, we're glad you're providing these services, or you should be providing these services, or Hartwell said, I can't provide these services. As a matter of fact, Hartwell himself testified that the termination was done pursuant to his request. Then Sharp came to him and asked an open-ended question, what do you intend to do with this market now that it's yours? And he said, well, I'm going to add some salesmen and that sort of thing. Sharp lost salesmen because Business Electronics was beating him in the marketplace.
Did Hartwell handle other products too? This wasn't his only line, was it?
It was not his only line. He handled numerous other office products. There's no evidence at all, by the way, that he did any advertising of Sharp during the time he was a Sharp dealer. The only evidence in the record concerning his advertising is 1981 and 1982, some 9 years after my client was terminated, and that evidence relates to his budget for his total advertising, which includes all of his products.
What percent of his total business was this line? Does it indicate, is this a major part of his business or just part of it?
I would say I don't believe there was evidence as to what percentage it was.
What about your client? Were you an exclusive? Is this the only product your client
this
handled?
This was the only client my product carried, Sharp Calculators. Nothing in this court's Monsanto case requires the rule adopted by the Fifth Circuit. That case does not limit vertical price fixing to a single form. It dealt with the minimum proof required to prove collusion, to show collusion in the vertical context. And there's no issue here as to collusion to eliminate price cutting. The evidence is not in dispute. Here the question is, what kind of conspiracy falls within the scope of the per se rule applicable to price fixing? A conspiracy to do what?
What would be the rule if a dealer came to his supplier and said, this fellow's too close to me, I want a bigger area, or I can make more money if you eliminate that competitor of mine across town? And the manufacturer says, okay, I agree to do it, and he does. What rule would apply there?
The rule of reason would apply there, Your Honor.
You can conspire to eliminate a competitor.
Well, subject to the rule of reason.
Yes, it's not a per se.
Not a per se. It's subject to the rule of reason. because it doesn't involve price. It's not price-related. It's not an agreement specifically aimed at stopping the price cutting of the existing dealer.
Well, I know, but it's aimed at stopping competition.
It is aimed at stopping competition, but...
And it's aimed at giving the favored dealer more business.
That's correct,
Your Honor. So is the price-cutting conspiracy.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Same result economically, isn't it?
Not quite, Your Honor, because
in this case, he's complaining because the fellow's cutting price and taking a lot of business from him.
Yes, he's complaining because of the lower prices. And those lower prices affect inter-brand as well as inter-brand competition. Mm-hmm. And so when you eliminate those low prices from the marketplace through conspiracy, it has a direct effect, an immediate effect, on both inter- and intra-brand price competition, whereas if the agreement to terminate has nothing to do with price, it may well have only effects insofar as price competition is concerned on intra-brand competition. Again, for example, if the dealer who is given the exclusive after somebody else is terminated is a price cutter himself, then he's still in there keeping prices low vis-a-vis other brands. So that would be the difference on effect.
Well, if it would have an adverse effect on inter-brand competition, you have to assume a pretty stupid manufacturer, since I assume he's getting the same amount from the distributor, no matter how much the distributor sells. Why would he want to reduce his share of the inter-brand market? I can't imagine why.
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor. What if... I don't think the manufacturer might want to reduce his share. He may want to reduce his share if he can charge higher prices. If he can achieve more overall profit through lower volume and a higher price, it might be to his benefit to do that.
Assumes that he can get a different amount from the distributor, but there's no indication in this case, nor do I think it's normal, that you charge the distributor a certain percentage of what he sells it for.
No, but I think it is common, Your Honor, for manufacturers' wholesale prices to rise and fall with retail prices. The cutting edge is at the retail end. The manufacturers cannot charge wholesale prices in ignorance of what's happening at the retail level. It's important to realize what's at stake here. The free riders that Sharp alludes to are really innovative, efficient businessmen who enable consumers to choose lower prices even if less service is provided. They're the Targets, the Kmarts, the discount drugstores. They are the businesses like Business Electronics in this case who want to be free to offer lower prices to their customers. At stake here is the freedom of these entrepreneurs to compete on price. And without price competition, all other competition is mere window dressing. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Tyler.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I think in listening to the argument of petitioner here, it is well for us to make very clear at the outset that Sharp is not contending that terminating a discounting dealer, such as was occurred here in June of 73, is always permissible. What we're arguing is that such a decision to terminate a dealer is not necessarily legal, that is to say, it is not per se legal and should be open to inquiry in the courts as to just what were the circumstances that led to that termination, what was going on in the marketplace, what services, functions, etc., that the various dealers hired in the marketing system of the manufacturer and supplier were doing best so as to be as competitive as possible in the interbrand marketplace. In other words, we're arguing that this court and the lower court should not presume conclusively that Terminating dealers is always anti-competitive. In many instances, as this Court has already recognized, in Sylvania and Monsanto, there can be circumstances where this kind of termination for price cutting is not anti-competitive, but pro-competitive, particularly when you measure what is going on, not only interbrand, but intrabrand. Now, let me suggest that one of the difficulties with the rule apparently argued for by petitioner is that without really doing any more than using the phraseology, the petitioner seems to assume that terminating a discounter is so obviously and exclusively and constantly pernicious that it can be assumed in each case to be anti-competitive. Again, that makes no great sense at all.
Mr. Tyler, I wonder if that's fair to your opponent's case, because he's not saying terminations are always bad. He's saying they're bad when they're done pursuant to an agreement with the person who's having his business taken away by the price cutter.
We may have a difficulty there, Mr. Justice Stevens. I think he may be using agreement a little more broadly than he ought. In other words, what happened here was, as you know, that actually there was an ultimatum laid down by the surviving dealer, Hartwell, in June of 73. And it is true that confronted with that ultimatum, our client Sharp said, we're going to go with the dealer that we think will do a better job because we don't think the discounting is helping us.
Yes, I know, but it'd be quite a different case if there'd been no ultimatum and no agreement.
No, I agree with you. Hear me out.
Yeah.
We could have the same argument if, for example, Sharp had a beauty contest here and suddenly sat down Hartwell and Business Electronics and said, fellas, I want to know that you fully understand what I'm trying to do. I'm going to shift my marketing. I'm not so happy with constant discounting. I want full service, pre-sale, point of sale, post-sale. Let me evaluate what you can do, and you tell me what I can do. That supplier, without an ultimatum, it seems to me, under existing case law, has every right to say, well, listen, I'm going to go with Hartwell. True, I might make a little more money in Houston for a while if I went with you, Business Electronics, because you sell cheaper. Presumably you'll sell more units. But I'm going for the bigger score. There are 100 people out there selling manufacturing calculators. And remember, this was a long time ago when calculators for business people were not cheap, $1,000, so on. Our argument is that dealer should expect that his supplier, in a beauty contest, as I call it, has every right to go with a dealer who is not the discounter. Also,
isn't that exactly what the judge instructed the jury? That it'd be perfectly all right to do it unilaterally.
Respectfully, Justice Stevens, I don't agree. What happened in the charge, and the most sensible fact finder couldn't help without more with the charge, what the trial judge, Judge Steeles, did was say, it is a violation of Section 1 if a terminated dealer, Business Electronics, comes in and says, A, I was terminated. No doubt about that. No issue of fact. B, there was some talk I was terminated because I was a discounter. Not much argument about that. Case is over. We say that the Fifth Circuit was right. You've got to do a little more than that. And it doesn't make any sense because there is no showing on that instruction or that view of the law that keeps in mind the purpose of Section 1, and that is to prevent a remaining dealer, Hartwell in this case, from being able to sit down with a supplier and actually tie Hartwell, the remaining dealer's hands, as to what he can charge. And that is what the Fifth Circuit found wrong. There was no real evidence about that, particularly in light of the charge, which didn't take that into account.
As I read the charge, the judge did distinguish between an agreement and a unilateral termination. But let me ask you this question.
Well,
assume there were three dealers, and two of them went to the supplier and said, we're both going to quit unless you terminate the third because he's a price cutter.
Well, then I'd be in a little trouble.
Why isn't that the same case? They don't agree to maintain prices themselves. They just say he is spoiling the market.
Because in the cases such as Sylvania and Monsanto, as I read them, this court has recognized that you have to be a little less wooden than that. You have to allow a dealer the option to say, hey, I have two dealers. One's a discounter, the other I consider a full service, or at least a better full service dealer than that discounter. There has to be flexibility to allow that manufacturer to make that determination. If he's in a highly competitive position, enter brand. And the distinction that the court below drew was perfectly sensible and consistent with Sylvania and Monsanto, because it said, look, you've got to go further, discounter who comes in with a treble damage action, and show there was some agreement to hobble or restrain the surviving dealers right to decide what to charge in that marketplace. And Business Electronics didn't do it. And with that instruction, there was no way in the world that the greatest jury or fact finder could avoid doing what they did, with no economic advantage, purpose, or fairness whatsoever. Think about another aspect of the argument petitioner makes. They seem to think that somehow what happened here was terribly offensive, but apparently are willing to recognize that the law of the land is that what happened here in practical effect is legal. And what I'm adverting to here is that once Hartwell was the surviving dealer, he became an exclusive dealer in the Houston area. The courts say you can do this. I would argue that once you say, hey, fella, you're an exclusive in Houston, that's a lot more devastating and stark to any discounter who was kicked out on that basis. The other thing is, the argument apparently, as I understand Business Electronics, is that, look, what was going on here leads to the possible cartelization of the calculator industry. Counsel for Business Electronics cross-examined the sales manager, a man named Burkholder, in this trial and brought out happily that at the time there were 100 firms in the business of manufacturing, like Sharp, and selling calculators. Cartelization with 100 competitors across this great country? Ridiculous. Another thing that the argument comes down to, as I understand the petitioner, is this, that we are in no trouble. The courts would do no offense to the teaching of Sylvania and Monsanto if they took the broad rule that they argue for. Well, it seems to me that that really is a little bit tough. As I read Sylvania, the court in that case reasoned and concluded that exclusive dealerships, which certainly eliminate intra-brand competition, are permissible. Now, if this court can say that, why not allow this? Particularly since all we're arguing for is not a free ride ourselves. We're simply arguing that the rule of reason should apply and we may lose. You recall in the decision below, Judge Clark pointed out his view of the evidence as he understood it in the trial record. There's evidence on both sides. I assume we're not here to argue with you or to ask this court to decide on the evidence, but the point is there should be a chance. And if the price cutter can show that what happened was the result of a true conspiracy to do no more than to fix retail prices through his surviving retail dealer or some other anti-competitive effect, then he wins.
Mr. Tyler, the Fifth Circuit majority sent this case back for a new trial to a properly instructed jury.
Exactly. And our only point is we want to support that. And we say that's fair and not inconsistent with what this Court has already held. True. The facts are different and so on. Let me make one other point, and that is this. One of the curious things about petitioner's argument here is that normally it would seem from an economic and practical point of view that if I were a supplier of a calculator, and I like to sell calculators, particularly in a big city like Houston, and if, as I think the marketplace truly was in the early 70s, you know, calculators were still coming along and weren't quite as popular as they are today, but very competitive. I would really hesitate to think that any sensible supplier would just say, willy-nilly, okay, other dealer, you come in and say, I get rid of the price cutter. I want to think about that a bit. Why should I throw out the fellow who might sell the most calculators in Houston unless there were powerful reasons in terms of what I was trying to achieve across the board, that I'd want somebody that doesn't discount as much? Let me point out another obvious economic circumstance here, which petitioner seems strangely to ignore in arguing on the law point here. There are suppliers in this world which don't like to be known as having a marketing system whereby they sell in discount stores. On Fifth Avenue in New York City, there are fellows who have signs saying, I'm going out of business tomorrow, come in and buy calculators and cameras at a discount. A few blocks over, there's Bloomingdale's. They sell these same things. Their suppliers don't want sometimes to sell their products by these discount guys on Fifth Avenue who have fire sales or going out of business sales. It seems to me that under the Court's existing reasoning in the earlier cases, such as Sylvania and Monsanto, leave open to a supplier the right and the capacity, so long as he doesn't do something to maintain retail prices at some level, if he makes the determination to go with somebody who doesn't charge prices.
Your Bloomingdale example makes me wonder, with respect to this particular case, if you say that the plaintiff is the fire sales store, he's always got fire sales signs up, and the surviving dealer, Hartwick, is the one, the Bloomingdale's in the pattern, and that Bloomingdale said we want to have no more fire sales. And if you terminate him, we won't necessarily agree to sell at your suggested price, but we at least won't do this fire sale business. We won't cut 30-40% off the list price. We'll just be on a kind of a reasonable price. Now, would that violate the antitrust laws under the Fifth Circuit holding?
If I heard you rightly, Justice Stevens, you threw in a number of parties. That's dangerous.
No, it's just three parties. You got a discounter fire sale person who sells at 40% off list.
Yeah.
You've got a Bloomingdale's that sells usually at list, but maybe 10 or 15% off from time to time, but no 40%.
Right.
Now, if the real discounter is terminated and pursuant to an agreement with the Bloomingdale's in this case, and the agreement is, well, you don't have to sell at list, but certainly you're not going to behave like this other fellow did and have fire sales all the time. Would that be legal?
Yes. So long as in this arrangement, the supplier, let's say Sony, to take it out of this case, says, Bloomingdale's, fine. I want to go with you because I think you're a better dealer and you're classier. I may sell more units with the fire sale guy a couple of blocks over. That's legal, we argue. Now, you understand that this encompasses what the Fifth Circuit recognized. I can't sit down then quietly as the manufacturer, Sony, and say, now, look, Bloomies, let's agree here and now that, you know, let's keep those prices pretty much what I say. If the fire sale guy, and I must say in fairness to my opposing counsel, I perhaps shouldn't call Business Electronics fire sale people. I don't know of any reason to think they were that way. But to take the analogy, I couldn't get away with that. And that's all the Fifth Circuit said.
I'm just wondering what the Fifth Circuit requires the plaintiff to prove on the retrial, that they maintained the specific suggested prices, they agreed to maintain specific prices, or just that they agreed not to discount as much as Business Electronic used to. That's
Forgive me, sir, I'm betraying my past and where I was a professional jury watcher for many years, but there's, from a jury's point of view or a fact finder's point of view, we can almost forecast what's going to happen. A, proof of termination. No dispute. We all know they were terminated in June of 73. The next issue, was there something said about discounting? I don't think there's any great issue about that. What's missing in this case is the awareness that there should be a proper instruction of the rule of law that would enable and require a terminated dealer to go one step further and show somehow, directly or indirectly, to the satisfaction of that properly instructed juror, that this amounted to an agreement, express or implied, to fix, to use Judge Clark's words below, the prices in such a way that was restraining the hand of the surviving retail as to what he'd charge for calculators. You see, that's the very important point here.
Would it be enough, Mr. Tyler, if it were just understood that, look, at the reason I'm terminating BE is because they were charging too little? Now, I don't care what you charge, Hartwell, but it's understood you're going to charge more than BE charged. Would that be enough?
That's getting close to the line.
Well, I understand the government's position very, very well. It's a nice, clear position. Doesn't matter price or not. Yours, I'm not sure what you want.
Wait a minute.
It's surely
you
enough.
You confuse me, Justice Scalia. The government's position. You mean in the antitrust divisions?
Right. In their amicus position. I mean that's clear and easy to apply. Yours, I think it's very fuzzy. I'm not sure how you instruct the jury.
No. I think it's not as fuzzy as you say, with all respect.
I hope not.
All we're arguing here is, look, what happened below was the judge said flatly, look, Section 1 lays it down as a matter of law that all this plaintiff, petitioner here, has to prove is, one, he was terminated. No doubt of that. Two, there was some talk about him discounting, and that's why he was terminated. Ergo.
No, that isn't what he said. Not that there was some talk about it, but rather it was terminated pursuant to an agreement. That was critical in the instruction and the finding.
But that's, if I may say.
Maybe you say that's a lot of nonsense, but that's
it
what
is
the jury
a lot
found.
Of nonsense in this sense.
You suggest there's no distinction between unilateral action and conspiratorial action.
No.
Which is exactly what the judge, that was what the judge asked the jury to decide.
The trouble with this is once you've used labels like conspiracy and agreement, they can be freighted with more meaning than the law or common sense should allow.
Congress picked the word.
I don't mind saying to you, Justice Stevens, that there was an agreement, in a sense, here. What else could there be? In runs Hartwell, who, by the way, had been mumbling and fumbling around and complaining for some time. Sharp had been saying, oh, no, we can't do this. We can't terminate these guys. Finally, there's an ultimatum. It's either us or them. The decision is made then. You can call that agreement, but that's not an agreement which is rendered illegal by Section 1 standing alone. That's our point. You see, we're not in here arguing that, hey, we deserve a medal. We are seeking from you Justice Stevens a ruling that once this kind of thing happens, it is deemed legal per se. We're saying they shouldn't argue that what happened here is illegal per se without more.
Yes, Mr.
Therefore, I don't understand this play on words of agreement or not agreement or not ultimatum, because
well,
I don't really
it's settled as a matter of jury determination that there was an agreement between the surviving dealer and the manufacturer that caused the termination of the plaintiff. That's the jury found that. And the Court of Appeals said, yes, there was an agreement, but it was not an illegal agreement.
Okay.
Unless one of the terms of the agreement was that the surviving dealer is not completely free to charge whatever prices he wants.
That
Justice
I wouldn't
Scalia and I have been asking you whether that means that they have to prove that, well, if you just have an understanding, we won't charge as low as Business Electronics would that make it illegal, or does it have to be an agreement to sell at list? And you seem to be unwilling
to put it in. I don't think there's any real difference between us. What I'm trying to say is, though, to answer what you and Justice Scalia are opposing, the real point is here, there would have to be some proof that, and the petitioner here, the terminated dealer, I assume, would bear the burden of proof, to show that the agreement was not just to terminate, but there had to be more, as you say. There had to be an agreement to restrict in some way the surviving dealer's capacity to charge prices as he wanted to. A good illustration is in this case.
You've been telling us that can exist. I mean, part of your earlier presentation was, look, if a manufacturer wants to go with a person who's going to charge a higher price and have a more quality product and more services and whatnot, he ought to be able to do it. But now you're telling me he really can't be sure that he's getting somebody who's going to charge the higher price.
No.
It can't even be part of his understanding that the non-terminated dealer will at least charge more than the discounter was charging. That can't even be part of it.
Well, I'm sorry, if you put it that way before, I missed it. This that you're now saying to me is quite a different spin. This is a forked fastball and not just an old-fashioned curve. What you're saying now is quite different. Let me repeat. What Judge Clark and the court below tried to say is all we're trying to say. There has to be some proof that once the terminated dealer is told, be gone, because you discounted and you did this and you didn't do that, then the law permits this so long as the discounted dealer who's terminated can't come in and show that there was truly a conspiracy in addition or an agreement, to pick up on the colloquy between me and Justice Stevens, what you will maybe an additional agreement to stay the hand or restrict the hand and come in with some form of resale price maintenance, which the law doesn't permit.
Let me be clear what your position is. You say it would be enough. The judge could instruct the jury. It is enough, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, if you find that when Sharp terminated BE, it was the understanding between Sharp and Hartwell that Hartwell, whatever other prices he might charge, would at least not charge prices as low as BE. If you find that there was even that minimal understanding regarding price, then you can fine for the plaintiff.
Now, that raises another problem.
Is that the instruction you want or isn't it?
No. I would like Sharp would like to be free of this kind of instruction. And this is Judge Seals. Listen to this. Quote, the Sherman Act is violated when a seller enters into an agreement or understanding with one of its dealers to terminate another dealer because of the dealer's price cutting. That's bad. We don't want that. We want the further instruction that you've got to go further and find that there was an agreement, express or implied, between Sharp and the surviving dealer to engage in some form of retail price maintenance.
The assurance that I just gave you, would that be enough?
The only thing I ask from you, Hartwell, is that you not charge prices as low as BE. I don't care what else. We have no other understandings. You can charge any prices you want, but at least this much is understood between us. You won't charge as low. You won't charge as low as BE. Would that be enough for a jury verdict against you?
Well,
you can answer that question. Oh, can't you,
Mr. Tyler? I really, if you're asking the point or raising the point again, which we don't like, let me take it this way. I would say to you that it should not be sufficient, as the Court of Appeals apparently thinks would be, although it's unclear, to simply go in and, among other things, have the charger of the rules of law applicable to this to say, look, the mere fact that everybody seems to agree that, A, there was a determination of discounter and a remaining dealer who picks up his work, that's maybe enough, jury, for you to infer an agreement to maintain retail prices at some level. I don't think that's enough, but I think this court has already answered this in Monsanto. Is that what you're getting at? Otherwise, I'm stupid.
I agree it can't be inferred, but I think you can answer this one yes or no. Ladies and gentlemen, the jury, if you find an explicit agreement between Sharp and Hartwell that Hartwell would not charge prices as low as BE's prices, then you can find Sharp liable under the antitrust laws. Would you accept that instruction?
I'd prefer to phrase it a little better, if I may say so, but I'll accept it.
All right.
All right? I'd use the word discount. I think I've overstayed my time to allow rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Tyler. Mr. McGowan, you have 2 minutes remaining.
I think we, first of all, need to be clear on the full instructions given by Judge Seals below. If you read the instructions in their entirety, he made it clear to the jury that the jury had to find a conspiracy to eliminate price cutting. And I'm quoting now from Joint Appendix 19, where the judge said, Sharp, on the other hand, contends that it terminated Business Electronics unilaterally, not as a result of any agreement or understanding with Hartwell, but because of Business Electronics sales performance. If you find that Sharp did not terminate Business Electronics pursuant to an agreement or understanding with Hartwell to eliminate price cutting by Business Electronics, then you should answer no to question number one. It's also important to repeat that the sufficiency of the evidence supporting the finding of that agreement has never been contested on appeal. We submit, Your Honors, that there should be the requirement of a further finding of some sort of direct agreement on price is mere surplus. What we have here is a form of price and agreement. An agreement to stop price cutting can't be anything other than an agreement on price.
Mr. McGowan, can I ask you the question Justice Scalia and I were asking your opponent? How do you interpret Judge Clark's opinion? Do you understand that you have to prove merely that there was some restraint, as I understand your opponent now conceded, on Hartwell's ability to price independently? Or do you have to prove that he agreed to follow the suggested retail prices of the manufacturer?
The latter is the way I understand it. I will confess to you that the term...
Each of you interprets it in a way more favorable to your opponent. It's strange.
I will confess to you that the term agreement on price at some level has always mystified me, exactly what it means. But the unfortunate thing is that, read literally, it's a narrow rule. If there would be no need to have a direct agreement on price if suppliers and dealers can police it discounting through collusive termination of discounters.
Well, but it's really a different question. I mean, I can agree with you that I'm getting rid of this discounter, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm not going to allow you to charge as low prices if, in the course of your business, you find you can charge that low a price and still make a good business for yourself. Maybe 10 years hence you might be able to find that.
But if the jury is instructed that in order to find a conspiracy, they have to find a mutual purpose to achieve an unlawful objective, and the jury finds that there was a mutual purpose, a conspiracy to eliminate price cutting. That is a purpose shared by both the supplier and the dealer. And the evidence supports that finding, then it has to be a form of vertical price fixing. It has to be a form of – there's no reason to have that purpose other than to eliminate price cutting. It is unrealistic to assume that the remaining dealer is going to charge lower prices.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. I think you've answered the question. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.